You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's In-Depth Series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Monday, June 20th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined in our virtual studio by former Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, who is running in this year's Democratic primary for the Lieutenant Governor position. It's a crowded field in that primary. There are three other candidates in the primary. Representative Kitty Toll, a former state representative from Danville, is in it, along with Woodstock State Representative Charlie Kimball, and political newcomer Patricia Preston, who is the Executive Director of the Vermont Council on World Affairs. And Mr. Zuckerman, great to have you with us today, Mr. Zuckerman. Before we get started, I should just tell our viewers that you served seven terms in the Vermont House of the Representatives from 1997 to 2011, and then two terms in the Vermont State Senate from, 2013 to 2017. And then in 2016, you successfully ran for the Lieutenant Governor position, which you held for two terms, and had a shot at the governorship in 2020, but well, now you're back again to take another crack at winning the Lieutenant Governor position. And I guess the obvious starting point for our conversation, I guess, is what prompted you to run for that office again?
Well, a lot of my public service over many, many years has been really to tackle issues that folks are struggling with every day, whether it was economic injustice issues, the social injustice issues that are being talked about a lot more today than they were when I first started, at least in stronger political circles and in social activism, and the climate. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, I ran for governor because I thought I could do more for those issues as governor than I could in the other roles I'd been in. The timing wasn't right. I had a shot at it for about 8 weeks, and then the pandemic struck. So I've been on the sidelines for a couple of years, and I've been watching the conversation at the statewide level. And while there's been some progress on some of these issues, I don't really feel that anybody who's serving in statewide, certainly I have different views than the governor on some of these things, but also in some of the other offices where there's real opportunity to voice the urgency of the climate crisis, the urgency of income inequality, the struggle people are facing with high prices, housing, heating, transportation, fuel, and of course the continued struggle that has only been amplified the last few years with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. That's happening both nationwide, but also, you know, we have statistics, very clear statistics in Vermont with our incarceration rates, with our school detention and suspension rates, that we do have disproportionate sanctions on people of color in our state. And so these issues are front and center. Economics is front and center. The climate, just yesterday was one of the windiest days I remember on the farm in the 20 years I've been farming here. We had row cover blowing off our crops, you know, half acre pieces that were getting shredded by the wind, exposing our crops to pests and issues. And so the climate, economics, and social justice are why I'm running.
What do you think is the way we're going to be able to make the transition from fossil fuel-based energy sources to clean, renewable energy sources without creating too much of a disruption in the economy? I mean, that seems to be the main argument right. To those who would say, hey, you know, we just got to keep drilling for oil because that's what makes things go. How do we get there?
In some ways, I would say right now, the answer is obvious with transportation. I mean, the folks that I know who have the opportunity to have electric cars, which is a bit of a privilege, I will obviously admit and put out there, they did not see and are not seeing the transportation cost increase that the average person with a gas vehicle, which I have, is seeing. So I think there are elements of the economy that will benefit as we move towards a more stable fuel price, a more stable fuel source. But that's going to take a few different factors. We know that about 75% of our fossil-based energy is split between housing and transportation. So we must make the investments in weatherization of our houses and also in our new construction, more efficient, smaller houses, which not only will be a little more cost-effective to buy for first-time homeowners, but others as well, but more cost-effective to heat. And so we can actually save people money by helping to renovate folks' homes to be weatherized. We have been underfunding that chronically for years and years and years compared to what we were told were the targets for the number of houses we could and should weatherize. And yes, these last 2 years and these next couple of years with all the COVID money, we're going to put a huge influx of money into that. And that's a real opportunity to create jobs. It's a real opportunity to save Vermonters money. But when I talked with a lot of the installers a few years ago, they said huge bumps in money that might not continue are actually difficult to work with as a business planning proposition. Because if you're going to buy more vehicles, you're going to train more employees, and you're going to bring people on, you want to know there's going to be a steady supply of that work for 3, 5, and 7 years, not 2 years of COVID money. So I think on the state level, we need to really start to think about making a commitment to maintaining those resources for a longer period of time. That's about priorities. That's about looking at saving money in other parts of government and or generating revenue from, in my opinion, progressive income tax methods so that we can create those jobs, maintain those jobs, and save working class Vermonters money, whether they're paying heat in a rental unit or they're paying heat in a small home that they own. And the same is with transportation. If we don't make electric vehicles more affordable for everyday people, then it will be difficult. It'll be very difficult for everyday struggling folks to make the changes that we would, I think many would like to see, but is out of reach for many people.
What do you think the state should be doing on the proposal for the clean heat standard that the governor vetoed and the legislature was unable to override the veto? I think it lost by one vote. Is that an idea that we should return to next year and revisit and perhaps get through all the way?
Well, I think we need to look at the clean heat standard, certainly, and there are elements. Most of that is good legislation. One more House seat somewhere in the state could make the difference. So when people think about, does your vote matter? Does who your legislator matters? I think that shows how much it matters. You know, if there's a House seat that's lost by 6 or 12 votes, which almost happens every year, that vote, those 6 or 12 votes could be the difference on the one vote of an override of the governor when it comes to climate policy. And that might energize, sorry for the pun, some people on the side that don't want that to pass. But hopefully it also energizes people to engage along with the congressional race and this race and others in this primary coming up that you can vote anytime in July and all the way through August 9th with our early voting. You can go to your clerk anytime. But I would say that the clean heat standard, maybe with some adjustments, I think there's some issues around biofuels that need to be narrowed and made more specific. But I think that's a piece of it. I really do believe that it's not only the fossil fuels on that end, but really looking at the Public Utilities Commission and how, with Governor Scott's appointees, they've been doing a slow strangulation of the solar industry in Vermont, of renewable energy in Vermont. And I think the legislature needs to put some clear language in or push back on the governor in some way with respect to how the Utilities Commission has really stifled the innovation and opportunity to have Vermont generate its own power. You know, right now we have this beautiful landscape. We love living here in Vermont. We love hiking. We love fishing. We love the farm fields and so forth. But we export the real costs of energy production. We export them to gas plants in Connecticut that are in marginalized communities. We export them to flooded lands in Canada that now aren't really necessarily emitting anymore because they've been flooded for so long, but it really changed the cultures that used to live, the indigenous cultures that used to live on those lands. And if we continue to buy power that is primarily from out of state, then we're really not taking responsibility for the lights that I have on here, the lights that are behind you there and in front of you there, running our computers, running the future of our electric cars, our heat pumps, the lighting and energy that we use in our homes. You know, I think it's time to take responsibility for our own use. And if we want to see less solar fields or fewer solar fields and fewer wind turbines, then we should have them in our view and recognize they're there because of the energy we use. And if we don't want them, then we need to figure out how to conserve more energy. And when you put it out of sight, you put it out of mind. And I happen to think we should generate our power here, and we need to work on the Public Utilities Commission to stop supporting the utility companies and the folks that say, not in my backyard, and instead say, you know what? We need to be responsible for energy production.
Hmm. How do we make the rural parts of the state, well, I guess most of Vermont is pretty much rural anyway, but you know, sure, what I mean, the rural communities, small towns,
yep,
economically competitive with the larger towns like in Chittenden County. It seems like nationwide there's this issue around rural, right, communities struggling to kind of keep up and retain their young folks, to have them stay there and get jobs created, businesses launched in rural communities. What do you think is the silver bullet, if there is just one bullet,
right,
or more than one, that we, yeah, should have to kind of get that process going?
Well, I don't think it's just one thing, but I also think and appreciate that you reflected that this is a nationwide issue. Rural communities are hollowing out. I think those rural traditions and rural cultures, warts and all, are also fading. And that's some of the struggle we're seeing with some of the energy around the country politically, and the anger and the frustration. We used to have manufacturing jobs spread throughout rural America, and those have primarily in the last 30 years been exported to South Korea, China, the Philippines, other parts of the world. I don't think we're going to return to those days. I grew up in very rural Virginia in the summers, and the tanning factory, the Levi's plant, the door manufacturing facility, they're all gone. And that means that middle class, working class people who aren't college educated used to be able to provide for their families, have a house, have a garden, and have a decent standard of living. So what do we do to rebuild our rural communities? I don't think that we're going to see manufacturing plants return to our rural areas. However, now that this federal money is here and we're able to spend that to broaden broadband throughout the state, I think we have an opportunity unique from some of the rural areas in the Midwest, which is that we are so close to Boston, New York, Albany, Montreal, Concord, that we can have people working remotely with their home base in one of those areas, or with their business serving customers in those areas, but they could live in our small towns of Vermont and work remotely and then travel every fifth or sixth week for 2 or 3 days and visit their clients. What that means is, if we build and if we look at zoning laws, if we looked at Act 250, if we look at our investments in our septic infrastructure and water supply infrastructure, and we invest in our rural villages and downtowns with denser housing, then those folks could live here, they could work here, they could spend their money here, and they would start to have enough critical mass in some of these communities to have the grocery store again, or the hardware store, or maybe even a creamy stand, you know? And so it's a matter of rebuilding our small communities in a relatively dense way. It doesn't mean 10-story buildings or 5-story buildings, but you know, if you have a short stretch with a building that's got 6 or 12 units or a few of those buildings, you suddenly have the permanent residential numbers to rebuild in that way, which then generates the sense of community again. On top of that, I think we could really invest in broadening the storage capacity for locally produced food. On our farm, we've turned some of the sections of our old dairy barn into fairly large coolers and storage rooms. And we're a larger farm. We do about 18 to 20 acres of vegetables, 30 to 40 hogs, 1,000 chickens. But a lot of farms that only grow 2 or 3 acres of vegetables, they produce in the summer, they've got the farm stand, but they don't really have the storage capacity to grow that extra 2 or 3 acres of carrots and beets and cabbage that could last into the winter. If in each town or every few towns, we built structures like the old apple co-ops that could hold larger quantities of food at a more efficient cost than each farm building $10,000 and $15,000 storage rooms, then we would start to be more food resilient with respect to the climate and possible future, knock on wood, pandemics. Hopefully we don't have those. But this really drove it home. When the pandemic happened and I saw the food fly out of my coolers in March of 2020, I realized how little food we had relative to the mouths we needed to feed. And I know folks felt it with toilet paper. They felt it with food and perishables. And I think we could start investing in rural resiliency that could carry our state through whatever the next challenge might be. So I think, you know, housing, relatively dense in our village centers, rural resiliency with food production are some of the backbones, along with broadband, to rebuilding our rural economy.
Interesting. The issue of gun safety has emerged. Well, it's been around for a long time now, but obviously the shootings in Buffalo and Uvalde, Texas, certainly drove that back to the
forefront,
the foreground again. I guess I just wondered, what is your feeling on what would be a common sense compromise around that that would bring together folks who feel very passionate about the Second Amendment and their rights to own guns versus trying to do something that would make the likelihood of what we saw in Uvalde or Buffalo or all the other places less likely?
Well, we're fortunate. A number of years ago, we did pass and the governor signed the magazine limit or the, you know, cartridge limit. And I think that's a good step in the right direction. But there's more we can do. We could have a waiting period, a modest waiting period of 2 to 3 days between when you go to purchase a gun and when you receive the gun. Why does that matter? Well, it matters for a few reasons. We've all gotten frustrated or angry at something in our lives, whether we're cut off by someone in the car, we honk the horn real quick, or we get frustrated. 10 minutes later, we've backed off and calmed down. If you can purchase a gun and go, you know, do something with it right away in a fit of anger, that doesn't give you that cooling off time. More importantly, we in Vermont have a huge number, about 80, I think it's close to 88% of our suicide, of our homicides by gun are suicide. Well, it's been shown over and over between research with individuals saying this themselves, that if they had immediate access to a gun, they would have committed suicide. But with a wait of some reason, whether they didn't have the car to go get it, or they lived in a different state that has a waiting period, they did not commit suicide. And they got the help they needed and have now been happier in their lives, and they're here to talk about it. A waiting period for someone buying a gun, whether it's for self-defense or for hunting, you know, you can get that with some planning and foresight before you would need it. And so I think implementing a waiting period is a pretty significant option that does nothing to impinge on the Second Amendment, but does create an added level of safety. You know, the additional factor around the Second Amendment, a lot of people cite the Heller decision by the Supreme Court. I read an interesting op-ed the other day in the New York Times, written by two justice clerks, one for the majority opinion in Heller, one for the minority opinion in Heller. And many, many people in politics and in these debates, particularly on the Second Amendment side, say, look, Heller made it clear you can't pass any more laws. They're unconstitutional. Heller was much narrower than that, according to these two opposite end of the spectrum clerks, who said the only thing Heller did was it said you can't take the guns away from somebody. They have a right to own that gun if they already have it. But it said there are many opportunities. Legislatures and government still have the opportunity to put parameters and guardrails and, yes, use another word, restrictions on some of the access of either the types of weapons or a slight delay on when you get them. And so we have to have that honest conversation that says, you know, if you're a law-abiding citizen who has not really had any issues or run-ins with the law and you haven't threatened a partner, you know, red flag kind of situation, you're going to be able to get your gun. What's a waiting period something to be so afraid of? So I think we can have that conversation if we have it in a rational manner, and we can make our community safer.
How do we get back or at least find our way to a situation where we can, as those two Supreme Court clerks did, have conversations with each other? We're on opposite sides of the political fence, perhaps, but we can disagree without being disagreeable.
Right.
It seems like that's something we've lost the ability to do.
Well, I think there's a number of things. I was just at the debate with Vermont Digger down at the Paramount in Rutland. So I think you're in Manchester, right? So they were just a little ways north of you there. But it was a wonderful debate and discussion. And actually, there was a very strong gun rights person there who I've met a number of times at the State House. And we were talking with one of the reporters, and he said, you know, one of the things I like about David, I disagree him on almost everything, but he'll always talk with me. He'll always listen. Whenever I'm at the State House, he'll come out of the office and chat with me or invite me in. So I have a track record of doing that. I think civil discourse, you know, I have the privilege to be able to talk about it and to take some barbs and not have them be as personal to me. Being a white middle-aged male in a position of power, or hopefully again in a position of power. But I think, and so I can take those barbs a little easier. But what I think is so critical is that we have to make sure there's room for people to voice their opinions. We also have to recognize that everyone is allowed their opinion. Now, opinions can be a different opinion. They can be sometimes hateful and mean and or ill-informed, and this can be true on all sides of the political spectrum. But you can't really debate someone's opinion. You can debate the facts they're basing the opinion on. And so let's have those debates. Let's talk about the facts around COVID and vaccines, or guns and gun violence that happens here and not in other countries, that have mental health issues, that have violent video games, that have economic disparities, but somehow they don't have the shootings that we do. Let's talk about the facts of what's possible, that the opinions are based on, and work to move the conversation. One thing I've often talked about with others is you have to go where someone is, hear them out, and then think about what information can you give that might move them a little bit closer. I don't think most people are going to go from here to here in one conversation. You've got to build trust. You've got to think about moving that opinion piece by piece. And maybe eventually when you pass a law, it might be in a chunk at a time that's bigger. But if you're not having those ongoing conversations and developing those trusting spaces where people can talk with very strong, divergent views, we're going to be in trouble. We're lucky. Here in Vermont, we can do that more. We have done that more. I think we do it better than the average around the country, particularly with respect to Washington. But when I talked to other lieutenant governors in other states when I was lieutenant governor about what's going on, they felt like, in particular the smaller states, but when they go home and they meet with people, they could often have rational discourse with divergent views. And it's when you get to the bigger levels and it's all through TV and social media that things start to get a little testy and maybe extra difficult. And that's on us. That's on us as elected leaders to treat people with respect. It's on us as constituents to reach out to our legislators with a modicum of respect to say, where are you on this issue? Well, can I offer you a different perspective? Or, great, I'm glad you're there. Keep going with it. Rather than saying, you better do this. You better do that. None of us do well with that finger being pointed in our face in everyday life. And your public officials in Vermont are everyday people that just happen to be trying to do good service for the state or the community if they're select board, or the schools if they're in the schools, school board. So I think it's on all of us to just take a breath before we overreact.
You're in favor of ending qualified immunity for state officials and police officers. The Supreme Court doctrine, I guess, that protects them from civil lawsuits, from being sued for citizens who violate their rights on the job. I guess I just wondered, you know, one of the concerns I've heard expressed about that is that the police departments around the state are struggling as it is to keep their staffing levels where they'd like them to be. And one of the arguments has been that ending qualified immunity protection for police officers makes it harder to recruit them. Yeah. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think you made an important statement in your question, which is protects these folks if they violate someone's civil rights while doing the job. I think it's really important that we recognize that no one's civil rights, no one's rights under the Constitution, can be violated or should be able to be violated by anybody. That's what due process is. That's what the courts are for. And so if in the line of duty, one violates someone's civil rights, then one is by default breaking the law no matter what position you're in. Now, violating someone's civil rights is actually pretty hard to do if you know the basic ways to treat people. And it can be harder as law enforcement in some respects because circumstances are fast. They're dangerous sometimes. But there are many instances where they weren't particularly dangerous as we look at national circumstances. And yet the police officer crossed the line. Courts in general, even without qualified immunity as a protective measure for law enforcement or civil officials, are not going to go straight for the jugular of folks who are in public safety. It's still about law and order and people breaking the law and following the law. I think there's a number of ways. Well, let me back up for a second. I know farmers who are looking for employees. I know schools that are looking for teachers. I know small businesses like my own as a farm looking for employees, but store owners, restaurants, you know, we're seeing a shortage across the spectrum. So I don't think there necessarily has to be a special carve out that one sector that is missing the opportunity to have full employment is sacrosanct to the point where we allow people to violate others' civil rights. I think if law enforcement, I also want to say, I have tremendous respect for law enforcement. I want people to really think about the fact that if you're a law enforcement officer and you're walking up to a car that you've pulled over, that car could be the one where you're at risk. If you're a law enforcement officer and you're called to a burglary, the minute you arrive, your life could be at risk. Or a school shooting, your life could be at risk. Or a domestic violence, which is one of the places where law enforcement often get hurt more than many others. So we have to remember that about our law enforcement, treat them with respect, give them the honor and dignity they deserve. And we have to think about our broader society and make sure that that trust is a mutual two-way street. And I've heard that the morale is down in law enforcement. And I understand that. I think the morale in our general public is unfortunately down between high fuel prices, the climate crisis, the devolution of our democracy. You know, times are hard right now. But the way to improve morale is to also, and the public trust, is to say, you know what, if it's only a few bad apples, then let's have law enforcement help us weed out the bad apples so that we can all feel like that the level of trust can be there. Because if you're someone who's in a marginalized community, you lost that trust a long time ago. And we have to recognize many of us who maybe haven't lost it because of financial privilege or skin or gender privilege. There's a lot of people that don't feel safe around public safety. And that is something we have to rewrite and fix. And that's on the community and on law enforcement. If we do that together and we pay people properly for the hard work they do and the risk they take, then I think we can rebuild.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Mr. Zuckerman, I really appreciate your time. Again, thank you for being with us today. And, well, good luck out there on the campaign trail. And who knows?
I appreciate it.
Another opportunity to talk a little bit later on this year.
Sure. If people want more info, it's Zuckerman, FORVT.com, right over my shoulder there, ZuckermanForVermont.com. You can email or call with questions, and I'm happy to go into deeper detail or answer something else for you. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you again for being with us. And thanks to all of you who have been watching as well. We hope you found our program interesting, and well, we'll see you again the next time. Meanwhile, have a great day.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.